PPI.org.
Thank you for joining Disability and Progress, where we bring you insights into ideas about and discussions on disability topics. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Charlene Dahl is my research team. And tonight we are talking about Alzheimer's. How did we fare during the pandemic? And what is Alzheimer's anyway? We'll find out all about that by talking with Dr. William. You'll have to help me. Manta?
Oops. That's really close. Yes, it's Manti. It's like a
Manti. My apologies.
No, you're all good. No worries at all.
Thank you so much for being on. Dr. Manti is a behavioral neurologist and of the U of M Medical School and M Fairview, specializing in the diagnosis and care of neurodegenerative disease, such as Alzheimer's disease. So thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Yes, well, we were thrilled to have you come on. So I want to talk a little bit about, first of all, I don't really know anything much about you except the little bit I got. So what made you decide to go into neurodegenerative diseases?
Well, I think it's a area of brain health that we really don't know much about currently. And We've definitely made a lot of pioneering progress in other areas of brain health, like multiple sclerosis, where now we have medications to treat that disease.
Right.
We've made progress in Parkinson's disease, where we can treat the tremor. We have medications to make patients move faster. But dementing illness like Alzheimer's disease, we still don't really have any good drugs. So I thought it was a field that had a huge unmet need. And I'm passionate about trying to find new ways to help patients. And that's why I chose that field.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. I'm so glad that somebody who has a passion is in there. I suppose that's, you know, you don't go into something like that unless you're really passionate about it. Can we start let's just start out by talking about what dementia is. So can you tell us what dementia is to begin with?
Yeah, thanks for the question. Dementia used to be synonymous with Alzheimer's disease. In fact, I would say up until the 1990s, maybe even up to the 2000s, the two words meant the same thing. So if you said, oh, my uncle has Alzheimer's, that was almost the same as saying he had dementia. However, that's not actually correct. So I'll talk more about what Alzheimer's disease is maybe later, but dementia is a disease that slowly robs someone of their ability to think. So it can be their ability to remember something, like where did we go for dinner last week or where did we go for dinner yesterday? It can rob people of their navigation abilities. So people will lose track of how do I get to my favorite store? How do I get to my favorite restaurant? And they can actually get lost instead of finding their way. It can also rob people of their language abilities. So people can actually lose track of what words mean. And some rare types of dementia can also rob people of their personality.
Okay.
So we see people who actually become a totally different person. So dementia is an umbrella term, meaning that it's a very general term that refers to any progressive loss of one's mental faculties. Alzheimer's disease is the leading cause of dementia, but again, dementia is just a general term for when people lose their cognitive abilities.
And how many different types of dementia are we talking about?
That's a question I don't have the answer off the top of my head, but there are dozens of different types of dementia. Most dementias are caused by abnormal proteins that accumulate in the brain, and those proteins are toxic and they damage the brain and cause the loss of neurons. And neurons are the cells that help us think. And so those proteins are what define the different types of dementia. I can talk about that more later, but one example is Alzheimer's disease that's caused by two different proteins, or at least that's how we define the disease.
Yeah. Well,
And so there's, I'm sorry, go ahead.
since you're there, why don't you talk a little bit about the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's?
Yeah, so Alzheimer's makes up about 80% of all cases of dementia. So again, dementia is sort of the general term. Alzheimer's disease makes up the bulk of what causes dementia. Alzheimer's disease is composed of two toxic proteins. One is called amyloid, and then the other protein is called tau. And those proteins you can only see under the microscope. You can't see them with the naked eye, but they accumulate in the brain over many decades. And in fact, it's thought that maybe Alzheimer's disease even starts in someone's teenage years, and that those proteins take so long to actually cause brain damage, but they do it so slowly over time that the symptoms only start when someone's, for instance, in their 60s, 70s, or 80s. So it's an extremely slow disease, but one that's devastating nonetheless.
Wow, teenage years, holy crumb. I can't even imagine. And
Yeah, it's definitely, what should I say? A time in the field where we're understanding a lot more about how the disease progresses over time. So what we know, though, is that it takes many decades before those proteins actually cause symptoms.
it feels like we misuse the words Alzheimer's and dementia then. Like you said, it feels like that's unless you really understand how dementia works or and Alzheimer's works, it feels like that's misunderstood. So are there different types of Alzheimer's, or is it just Alzheimer's is Alzheimer's?
Thanks for that question. That's a question that's still an area of active research, but the answer is yes. So the most common type of Alzheimer's disease is the type where someone can't remember, what they did yesterday, or they can't remember what their spouse told them already 10 times. For instance, we have an upcoming doctor's appointment, and then their spouse might have to repeat that 10 times and they still won't get it. So that's the memory type of Alzheimer's disease. And that's, again, probably 80% of all types of Alzheimer's disease. But then there are more rare types of Alzheimer's disease. One is called posterior cortical atrophy, and that's a mouthful, but it's the type of Alzheimer's disease that interferes with your visual spatial functioning. So people will lose their ability to park a car. Parking a car involves a lot of visual spatial skills. You have to know where the car is. You have to know where the parking spot is. You have to know how the car turns. You have to know where the car is in space as you're moving it. So there's a lot of visual spatial processing that happens when you drive. And so those individuals will lose their ability to, for instance, drive a car. They might lose their ability to look at a movie and be able to tell how many characters are on the screen because they can't process all the visual imagery in front of them. So that's the visual spatial type of Alzheimer's disease. And that's, again, a rare type of Alzheimer's disease. There's another type that robs someone of their language abilities and they can't find words anymore. So it makes them extremely, it's extremely difficult for the individual to find the correct word. And then there's an even more rare type of Alzheimer's disease where someone loses their personality and they become a totally different person and engage in socially inappropriate behavior, like belching in public or talking about very personal matters to someone at a shopping center line, those types of behaviors. So Alzheimer's disease can affect really any area of the brain, but the most likely area that it affects is memory. And that's why When we see someone with memory problems, we generally think that the most likely cause is Alzheimer's disease in the right setting.
So what are the stages of Alzheimer's?
Yeah, so right now there's different stages. There's what's called the pre-symptomatic stage. And that's the stage when, you know how I said that we think the proteins start to accumulate when someone's a teenager?
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's say there's someone like me, you know, I'm a 36-year-old guy. You know, I technically could have Alzheimer's disease, but the proteins haven't caused enough damage yet. And so, you know, if I'm thinking okay and not having any problems, I would be in what's called the pre-symptomatic phase, meaning that I don't have any symptoms yet. Then there is what's called the mild cognitive impairment phase, where people are just starting to notice problems that interfere with certain very complex activities. So, for instance, someone might have trouble doing taxes. You know, even normal people have a lot of trouble doing
I was going to say, uh-oh.
Taxes are hard. And if you can't do taxes, that's not necessarily a red flag. But, you know, that's one of the first things to go because it is something that's pretty hard to do. You know, or the car breaks and they're not a mechanic and they have to figure out, you know, what part do they need? How do they fix a car? Doing something new that requires a lot of learning might be a symptom someone with mild cognitive impairment has, but they're still able to function in their other day-to-day activities. So that's the mild cognitive impairment stage. And then we start crossing over into the dementia stage. So again, dementia is a general term. And what we mean by dementia is when someone can no longer do everything independently. So they start needing help with day-to-day activities. So they might need help with appointments. They might need help with grocery shopping because they just can't organize and remember what items to get. And the first phase of dementia is called the early dementia phase. And that's a phase when maybe loved ones will know that the person has a problem, but if they just go to a casual meeting or meet someone, let's say at a bus stop, that person might not notice that they really have a problem. And then after the early dementia phase, there's what's called the moderate phase. And the moderate phase is when someone starts needing help with routine things that happen on a very frequent basis. So making sure that their medications are ready and available, being able to cook and clean dishes, being able to use, you know, the laundry machine, you know, being able to take a shower and, you know, use the faucet, you know, those things might start becoming impaired in the moderate phase. And then the last stage of Alzheimer's disease is the severe stage. And the severe stage is when someone needs help with things that people need just to survive. So they might need help with getting food to their mouth, or they might need help, you know, cleaning diapers because they can no longer stay continent of urine and stool. They might need help moving. You know, at the end stage of Alzheimer's disease, people have difficulty moving their limbs. You know, they might need help getting out of bed or into bed or getting clothes on. So that's the last stage of Alzheimer's disease. So just to briefly sum it up, there's the pre-symptomatic phase, there's the mild cognitive impairment stage, there's the early, moderate, and severe stages of dementia. So those are kind of the overall spectrum of different severities of any type of dementia, but of Alzheimer's disease too.
And is there a general timeline that Alzheimer's would take, or can it be anywhere from, you know, brief to long?
Yeah, that's another very perceptive question. So I always tell my patients that everyone is different. One thing that I'll say is the average amount of time between diagnosis and someone passing away is about 10 years. And that's, again, an average. And there's a lot of variability around that. That's, again, not the time between when the proteins accumulate and when someone passes away, which, again, we understand is many, many decades.
Mm.
But the time that someone comes into my office and says, I have problems, and then the time that they pass away is, again, in general, 10 years. But there are, again, a lot of exceptions to that general rule. There are patients who have Alzheimer's disease that start having symptoms, and the symptoms progress extremely rapidly, and they actually pass away within a year. And that is a very aggressive form of Alzheimer's disease. And we still don't know why certain forms of Alzheimer's disease are more aggressive than others. Then there are people who are the opposite, who get symptoms of Alzheimer's disease and stay basically the same for 1 or 2 or 3 decades.
Wow.
And we still don't exactly understand why that's the case too. One thing that I will say though is that the brain is an organ in your body that never heals itself. So unlike if you break your bone fixes itself. If you, you know, cut your skin open, your skin will heal over, you'll have a scar, but you know, you'll still heal over. But your brain really, you know, those neurons, once you lose them, you know, they're gone. So the brain is kind of like a record of all the bad things that happened to it throughout its entire life. So if you had a concussion, let's say when you were, you know, in sixth grade, or you played college or professional football, or you, you know, took certain medications or certain drugs that were dangerous to the brain, or let's say that you also had, you know, no opportunity to really get an education, you know, a lot of things can contribute to brain health. And so Alzheimer's disease is certainly bad for the brain, but when there are other bad things that are also happening to the brain, Alzheimer's disease can do even more damage. It's kind of like adding insult to injury if you have already pre-existing brain issues. So one thing that we believe is that people who have a slow form of Alzheimer's disease probably have a healthy brain to begin with. You know, they might have had a lot of exercise growing up. They had a lot of stimulating activities when they were young and when they were in midlife. They weren't exposed to air pollution.
Right.
You know, they you know, ate healthy throughout their life. So again, there are certain things that you can do throughout your life to make your brain as healthy as possible, so that if you do develop Alzheimer's disease, it's not as aggressive.
We need to take a short station break, and we will be right back.
Programming on KFAI is supported by Metro Transit. Metro Transit now offers use of an app that connects blind and low vision customers to a live agent for navigation assistance during transit trips. More information at metrotransit.org/AIRA.
And we're back. This is Disability and Progress and KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. My name is Sam. We're speaking with Dr. William Manti. Did I get that right?
There you go. Still spot on.
All right. So I want to step back just a minute and talk about something I read, and I wasn't sure why. I saw something on Down syndrome and that it was linked in some way, that if you have Down syndrome, you are like 50% more likely to have Alzheimer's. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So what I'll first say is that individuals with Down syndrome, if they live long enough, will almost inevitably develop Alzheimer's disease. And I know that's, you know, a hard thing to say, and maybe callous to say too, but we understand that Down syndrome, you know, what causes it is when you have 3 copies of the 21st chromosome.
Ah, okay.
So, you know, everyone has 2 chromosomes. I should say most people have 2 chromosomes, for one from the father and one from the mother.
Right.
But in Down syndrome, the baby will inherit usually 2 chromosomes from the mother and then 1 from the father. So they have 3 copies of a gene instead of 2 copies. So again, normal individuals will have 2 copies of a gene, and then in Down syndrome, they have 3 copies of the 21st chromosome. And on that chromosome is the gene. And again, genes are the instruction manual for proteins. Is the gene for amyloid. And so essentially there are three instruction manuals telling the cell, and you know, cells are the building blocks of tissues, telling the cell to make the amyloid protein. And so there is much more amyloid protein being made in people with Down syndrome than in normal individuals. And the amyloid protein is one of the ways that you can develop Alzheimer's disease. And the amyloid protein is toxic, and again, slowly accumulates over time and can cause brain damage. And so individuals with Down syndrome actually develop Alzheimer's disease at an extremely high rate. And if they survive into their 40s and 50s, the chances of having symptoms from Alzheimer's disease becomes quite high.
I want to talk a little bit about diagnosis. I was listening to when you said, you know, how people can, some of the symptoms, and where you may not remember where you go out to eat last week. And I'm thinking, uh-oh. But it is normal in some respects to forget certain things sometimes. All of us have misplaced something one time or another and thought, where the heck did I put that? So when does it become a problem? When and how do you even diagnose that there is a problem?
Yeah, thanks for that question. There are a couple different ways that we diagnose someone with Alzheimer's disease, or at least the type of Alzheimer's disease where they have symptoms due to the proteins. Because again, the proteins take many decades to accumulate, and you can still be normal even with those proteins around. But once we detect that there are symptoms, then we start asking about what type of symptoms they're having. So I 100% agree with you that it's totally okay to lose your keys, to maybe forget where you parked your car, to, you know, forget that someone told you about, you know, an upcoming event that just you spaced out on and you know, you missed. When it starts to become concerning, though, is when it's happening extremely often, and when it's happening despite numerous reminders. And what is even more concerning is when someone says, oh, do you remember that we went to a movie last night? And the person says, I have no idea what you're talking about. Or it's when you provide a reminder and the person still doesn't know what you're talking about. Frequently, when we're provided reminders, we can kind of jog our memory and we say, oh yeah, I know what you're talking about now. You know, yeah, I remember last week. Now that you say it, I remember that we went to, you know, get pizza. And then after that, we, you know, went to go for a bike ride. Again, it's normal not to be able to remember that off the top of your head. But when someone is reminding you of something and you still really don't remember it, and there's not an alternative explanation, like let's say the person had a concussion, or let's say they were intoxicated, or, you know, maybe they were taking a medication as a painkiller, and we've excluded these other possibilities that could explain it, you know, then it starts to become worrisome. So once we get that level of being worried about someone, we then get a brain MRI. And a brain MRI is basically a fancy term for a brain scan. And we actually look at the brain and we try to figure out questions like, is the brain shrinking? Is there a brain tumor that could be responsible for the symptoms? You know, did the person maybe have a stroke? Is that the cause of their memory issues? So the MRI can really provide a lot of answers to, you know, what may be going on. And if the brain MRI shows shrinkage, then that tells us, you know what, this is not, you know, a good sign. You know, this is not normal that the brain is shrinking. This could be Alzheimer's disease. And again, in Alzheimer's disease and other dementias, the brain actually does shrink because those neurons are dying.
They're
losing cells. If the brain, you know, looks somewhat normal, then we explore other reasons why the person could be having problems. We ask a lot about medications. We ask about substance use. We ask about, you know, psychiatric disease. You know, certainly severe depression, PTSD, severe anxiety can sometimes cause severe memory problems too. So we ask about those diseases. So we basically do a comprehensive review of all medical issues that could alternatively explain the situation. And then finally, we also look for certain vitamins and certain minerals. You know, there's a lot of diets out there nowadays, and sometimes people don't get the right amount of vitamins and minerals in their diet. And we want to make sure that they're not missing a key vitamin that they need to maintain their memory.
Do we have statistics on Alzheimer's?
Yeah, so about 1 in 10 people over 65 in the United States has Alzheimer's disease that is symptomatic.
Is there a gender preference?
Yeah, so women are more likely to get it than men. And entirely sure why that's the case yet. But there is a gender preference, and that's an area of extremely active research right now in terms of why are women more likely to have it than men. But there is a gender preference, that is correct.
And is it hereditary?
It is highly hereditary. There are certain genes that almost destine you to have. And again, genes are what the parents pass down in the form of kind of an instruction manual that tells the cells what type of proteins to make. But there are certain genes that will almost predestine you to get Alzheimer's disease. But those are very, very rare, and they typically cause symptoms of Alzheimer's disease in someone's 30s and 40s. So that's a very, very rare form of Alzheimer's disease that causes symptoms that young. There's another gene out there that's the most common genetic reason for Alzheimer's disease, at least in the United States, that increases your chances of getting Alzheimer's disease by about triple. So, you know, again, if you live to 65, you just have a 1 in 10 shot getting Alzheimer's disease. So now you have a 30%, you know, 3 in 10 shot having Alzheimer's disease with this particular gene. It doesn't predestine you to get it, but it at least increases your chance. And then finally, it's also a disease that sometimes we think of as a deck of cards, where you can just be dealt, you know, a bad set of, you know, 5 cards. Mm-hmm. And so there's sometimes multiple different genes that have to come together to kind of stack the deck against someone and cause the disease. So there are certain genes that predestine people. There's one gene that increases the chances significantly. And then it's also thought to just be bad luck sometimes when you just get multiple genes that come together to really create a bad situation.
Mm. How did we fare during the pandemic? What happened with people with Alzheimer's? How did the pandemic make it worse? Did you find, or have you been finding anything that says, I don't know how you do this, but that maybe the pandemic caused more Alzheimer's?
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up. Maybe I should have talked about this, your previous question, but I'll answer it here. So one of the things that we know is important to not only preventing Alzheimer's disease, but to delay the worsening of Alzheimer's disease is to make sure that the person suffering from the disease has a social outlet. So, you know, I always tell people the brain is a little bit like a plant that needs sunshine. And you need to have the person who has Alzheimer's disease feel stimulated, whether it's having a conversation with them, you know, taking them to a different location, you know, whether it's a walk around the facility they're in or a walk around the block, you know, watch a movie, you know, put music on. Those things are actually really helpful for the brain to essentially stay happy and not decline as fast. And I think COVID was absolutely devastating to individuals with Alzheimer's disease. I honestly think that, you know, there's not many other things in life that are that kind of depressing. And, you know, being alone with this disease, you know, not having your family come, you know, be able to visit you.
Right.
You know, be able to provide you that conversation, you know, being able to bring in, you know, your grandkids so that you can feel like there's youth and there's, you know, an energy in the room, you know, not having someone say, I love you, not having personal touch. You know, personal touch is, again, something that's really helpful for brain health. You know, humans we're primates, and, you know, we really thrive off of that social aspect of, you know, personal touch. And it was a terrible, terrible time for people living with dementia and not having any of those social outlets.
And I think I read, too, that people who have experienced some significant depression in their lives, they may be at greater risk. Is that a real thing, or are they just speculating?
Yeah, no, that's definitely true, that if you have depression, you're, you know, more likely to develop Alzheimer's disease. But we don't know if that's a cause, as in if you're depressed, then that's going to cause Alzheimer's disease, or whether it's the reverse, whether Alzheimer's disease causes depression.
Ah, interesting.
And we think it's probably maybe a little bit of both, but we definitely know that Alzheimer's disease can cause depression. So Alzheimer's disease, again, we think is caused by these two toxic proteins that accumulate in the brain. And those proteins, they actually invade and they destroy the areas of the brain that produce serotonin. So serotonin is kind of that hormone that's like telling you that I'm content with my life. It's not the hormone that says, oh, I'm, you know, basking in pleasure. This is the most, you know, ecstasy I've felt, you know, ever. It's not that type of pleasure. It's just this general feeling that, yeah, I'm okay with my life. You know, things are all going okay. It's this feeling of contentness. And Alzheimer's disease essentially takes away serotonin. And so we see that people in the early phases of the disease can get quite depressed. I've seen some patients who that's actually the first symptom. You know, they tell me, you know what, I got really depressed 3 years ago. And then 2 years after that, I started losing my memory. So we kind of are learning that, you know, there is a mind-brain connection. You know, like if you affect the brain, you're going to also affect your mental and your psychological health. But yeah, so that's a long-winded answer to your question. But yeah, a good question to ask.
Charlene, do you have any questions so far?
I'm pretty fascinated. Just to let the doctor know, I worked at the VA in North Chicago for many years, in fact, over 20. And one of my jobs was the first Alzheimer's specific unit for the VA guys. And it was interesting because women are usually the victims of Alzheimer's, but we had all the men, and it was quite interesting. And what we've learned so much from the 80s until now, it just blows me away.
Yeah, that's a great point you make. I agree.
And the medications have changed a little. How much they're used and which ones they're using now. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Definitely. Yeah. Thanks for the question. We still are a little bit in the dark ages, but I agree with you. There is more now than there was in the 80s. You know, right now there's two classes of medications that we use to treat Alzheimer's disease. The first one boosts a level of a chemical in the brain that promotes alertness. And it's a medication that is a little bit of a drop in the bucket. It can help a little bit, but sometimes it doesn't really do a whole lot. Mm. But we still offer it to patients because we don't have much else right now. And then the other medication is what's thought to be a neuroprotective medication. So what that means is that it protects the brain against too much excitement. So one of the theories of Alzheimer's disease is that the proteins cause the neurons to essentially get a little bit overexcited, and that overexcitement can actually lead to them dying. And so this is a drug that kind of dampens down the excitement of the brain and is thought to protect it. But it's again a drug that's I'll use the term a drop in the bucket. It doesn't do a whole lot, but it's again all that we have available. I'm planning on having the question asked about this new drug called aducanumab that was approved by the FDA, and I can really talk about that now or later. But I'll just say briefly that that's, you know, a very controversial drug. We still don't really know if it works well enough to offer it to patients. It has a lot of toxicities, and we're still trying to figure out which patients might benefit the most, if any. So.
Yeah, and my understanding about that was that the FDA did approve it, but the medical field wasn't thrilled. Is that correct in thinking?
Yeah, I think you, you know, summarized it very well just there. You know, I think the FDA also wasn't too thrilled in a way because they approved it not based on it working to help with symptoms. They approved it based on it taking out amyloid protein. So it does a good job of taking out amyloid protein, but it doesn't do a whole, it doesn't do a noticeably good job at actually helping out with the symptoms. And there are a lot of different theories out there for why that's the case. We know that amyloid is toxic to the brain, but we're not sure why the drug, by taking amyloid out, is not actually, you know, doing a whole lot for symptoms. One theory out there is that you're kind of sending in the, what should I say, you're not strategically able to take out amyloid without hurting the rest of the brain. It's a bit like dropping a cluster bomb or like an atom bomb, you know, on a city where you're trying to, you know, take out a certain target. And yeah, instead of just,
you may take out a whole lot more.
Yeah, you know, exactly. And we know it's a drug that causes brain bleeding, it causes brain swelling. You can have seizures with the drug, you can have strokes with the drug. So, you know, it's a little bit like,
which is a lesser of two evils.
Another analogy would be like hitting a nail with a sledgehammer, you know, where you might kind of, you know, do too much. That's one theory. There's a lot of other theories out there, but that's one of them. Another theory is that you're catching patients too late. So, you know, I said that the amyloid protein we think starts to build up even in someone's teenage years.
Yeah.
Well, then why are we taking it out after the brain is already being damaged? Are we intervening, you know, decades too late? You know, it's sort of like treating cancer after someone has the cancer that's spread to their brain and spread to their pancreas and spread to their liver. You know, at that point in time, even with the best cancer drugs we have right now, there's not a whole lot we can do. You know, we need to catch cancer as early as possible. And that's why people go see their doctors all the time. You know, the same thing applies to dementia. Are we catching dementia too late and treating it too late? Is that why it's not effective? So that's another theory out there. But what is, I think, clear to most people, what most people agree on is that the drug is quite toxic and the actual benefits are still questionable.
There was another thing I saw was a Bredesen protocol. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, so Bredesen
non-medicated, right?
Yep. So there's no medications, at least no pharmaceutical medications involved in the Bredesen protocol.
So how does that work?
So the Bredesen protocol has a lot of things that, and I'm going to kind of share my opinion here, just for the sake of time. But has, in my opinion, two different arms to it. You know, one arm is what I will call well accepted and what I would recommend to anyone with any type of brain disease, whether it's dementia or any other type of neurological condition. And that is, one, to get exercise. So we know that exercise is probably the number one thing we can do to promote brain health. And I tell my patients all the time that we recommend half an hour of physical activity five times a week. The other thing is just eating a balanced diet. So, you know, a lot of us, you know, we live chaotic, we live stressful, we live busy lives. And so, you know, a lot of us eat processed foods and, you know, might not eat vegetables or fruits, or might not have time to go to the grocery store, might not have the income to buy, you know, these, you know, types of fresh legumes.
Right.
And so, you know, diet is a huge issue in the United States and other countries as well. So the Bredesen protocol recommends adhering to, you know, a diet that at least isn't heavy on, you know, fats and processed foods and sugars that a lot of us, you know, have as our mainstay diet.
Chocolate,
that's an interesting question. You know, a lot of people think that chocolate is actually good in moderation. So we definitely say, you know, chocolate is okay, but, you know, in moderation. So
yeah, that there's a small line for me there.
Yeah.
I tend to step over. So yeah. I get it, the diet, stress, those things. The other thing that I wanted to touch on is sleep, that you're hearing a lot in the everywhere now. Amount of sleep can really depend on how well you focus, how well you think, and even maybe lead to earlier dementia or Alzheimer's. So is there anything to that, or are we still, is the jury out with the sleep deal, and they're using anything they can to try to keep you on a more narrow path?
Yeah, that's another fascinating question. It's a little bit like your question on depression, where does insufficient or bad sleep cause Alzheimer's disease? Mm-hmm. Or is the reason why patients have bad sleep because it's actually the Alzheimer's disease that's disrupting our sleep-wake cycle? Again, we think it's a little bit of both, that you get into this vicious circle. What we do know about sleep, though, is that sleep is the time of our day or night when you get rid of toxic proteins. So your brain actually is producing toxic proteins all day. You know, when you're thinking, when you're going around, when you're doing things, you know, just being awake, you produce these toxic proteins. And when you sleep, it's actually a time when the brain is able to more or less recycle and push out those toxic proteins. Mm-hmm. So there is a strong theoretical underpinning to the idea that sleep is a key factor in order to get rid of those toxic proteins and avoid developing Alzheimer's disease or other dementias. On the flip side, Alzheimer's disease definitely can cause sleep disruption. So there's an area of your brain that tracks what time of day it is, and that tells you subconsciously that you're tired, or that you should wake up, or that you know, now is the time that you're able to fall asleep. And you know, that's kind of your internal clock. You know, people refer to that as your circadian rhythm. Uh-huh. And Alzheimer's disease disrupts that circadian rhythm, and frequently you see patients with Alzheimer's disease who have a real tough time adhering to a normal bed routine. So you know, they'll be up all night and sleeping all day. And then when you try to move that around, you know, that can be very problematic. Mm. Patients with Alzheimer's disease tend to sleep more too. They tend to sleep just longer. You know, frequently I have patients who sleep 16, sometimes up to 18. I had one patient who slept 20 hours a day. You know, wow. It's as much as a koala sleeps.
That's funny.
We're not really sure why that's the case, but some people think that it's the body's attempt to actually get rid of those toxic proteins and say, well, sleep is one of the ways we can get rid of that toxic protein. We know that we have, this is again, me kind of pretending I'm the brain talking. Why don't we get rid of these toxic proteins? Let's just sleep more. That's one theory, that the body is trying to sleep more and more to get rid of those toxic proteins. But again, we're not really sure what's happening, but it's still an area of active research.
So, Dr. Manti, I totally see your passion in this, and figure we could probably talk for another 40 minutes. We don't have it, but I wanted to touch real quickly on, because you're doing research, I think, with the development of image and biomarkers for neurodegenerative disease. Yes?
That's true, yeah. Yep.
Can you talk a little bit about that briefly?
Yeah, well, I think one of the success stories of the last couple years is that there will almost certainly be a blood test for Alzheimer's disease within the next couple of years, maybe even 1 year. So there are new technologies that can detect those proteins that are in the brain by just looking at the blood. So those brain proteins actually seep out in very, very small amounts into the bloodstream. And there are new machines that are sensitive enough that they can detect those proteins in the bloodstream. So people will be able to go to their doctor with memory problems and say, you know what, I might be having Alzheimer's disease, I don't know. And instead of having to go through a lot of really expensive tests, they can just get one of these blood tests. It still wouldn't obviate the need, or I should say get rid of the need to have someone take a very detailed look at anything else that could be contributing to memory loss. Because again, like I mentioned, there's a whole slew of things that can also cause memory loss, but it at least would simplify the whole process significantly. And it would speed up the referrals to people like me, who would be able to really quickly and accurately get people a diagnosis. And I think that's going to be really huge to future drugs that treat Alzheimer's disease, because going back to that idea that we need to treat people before the brain starts to die, because we still don't have any drugs on the horizon that can bring back dead brain cells. It's like, I'm maybe dating myself here, but you know, Christopher Reeves, when he fell off his horse, he's paralyzed. Once you're paralyzed, there's still no coming back from that. And that's because the brain still cannot regenerate. And there's still no drugs on the horizon that will do that.
So
I'm sorry, go ahead.
So then that might you start testing really early? Like, how early are you talking that you could test?
Yeah, and that's an excellent segue, and you're kind of seeing where this is going. So we're thinking that we might even start testing people as early as their 30s, for instance. It's kind of like getting a cholesterol check when you're in your 30s, and if you have a high cholesterol, then maybe think about taking a cholesterol lowering medication or engaging in a healthier lifestyle.
I can see though where people might say, I think it's great and all that you can test, but if you don't have something for me to, slow things or do whatever, I don't want to know.
Yep. And it's certainly an ethical issue too. Because there's certainly discrimination, whether it comes to
insurance. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Yep. So do you want that to be, an albatross around your neck that, like I said, health insurance companies are technically not allowed to discriminate, but who knows?
You know they do.
Looks like.
Yeah. We've all been there when they have. So, and then there, you could try to count it as a pre-existing maybe, but then there's that whole catch-22 with that one.
Yeah. So it's a really, fraught ethical and I should say practical. I mean, like I said, this has real implications for people. And I agree with you that those blood tests really wouldn't start to be tested in younger individuals until there is a therapy that can do something about it. It's a little bit like, maybe a colonoscopy that people get now. Mm-hmm. When you turn 50, you're supposed to get a colonoscopy so that you can make sure you don't have colon cancer. So if you do have it, you can at least take it out before it starts spreading everywhere in your body. And that's, something you get whether or not you have colon cancer. It's just a screening test. So people think that maybe that's the same direction this will go once we have effective therapies. But again, that's one avenue the future might take. But I think a lot of it depends again on, like you were bringing up, these really important issues when it comes to insurance or employment or, one's own anxiety levels, knowing, am I going to be not recognizing my family members in 20 years? I mean, that's not something that is easy to obviously live with.
So, but here's
a lot of issues that we have to grapple with.
Here's a flip side, though. Does the medical field believe enough in diet, exercise, and et cetera, to think that, if we tested you when you were 20, maybe you can make enough changes to get it much later or to slow things? Do you believe enough in those other things to and that's a question to you, do you?
Yeah, I think that it's a double-edged sword, and it can be used for bad things, but it can be used, that information can be used for good things too. I'll compare it to there's this company you probably have heard of called 23andMe. It's it's a way to get your some of your genetic information, for a pretty low cost.
Right.
And I have a lot of patients come to me and they say, I got my 23andMe and guess what? I have the two genes that increase my likelihood of developing Alzheimer's significantly. And my mom had Alzheimer's. And so what do I do?
And that stress that you now have should even make it go faster.
And you know, those people also deal with insurance discrimination because they, you know, life insurance is more expensive, disability insurance is more expensive. So, you know, already they have that sort of discrimination. But like you were saying, I can tell them if you exercise and you prioritize exercise in your life, because we all have so many things pulling us in different directions. You know, we have our work, we have our family, we have our mental health, we have our hobbies, we have our friends, we have our, you know, you name it. Like we have so many different things going on in our life. And sometimes you have to prioritize and, you know, make tough decisions. And when you know that you're at high likelihood of developing Alzheimer's disease and you have one thing that you can do to avoid it, like getting exercise, you know, that might help that person. They might say, you know what, I have that information and I'm going to act on it. I'm going to, you know, make sure that I carve out half an hour a day, 5 days a week to get exercise. So yeah, the information can be useful. But I think it has to be used, you know, for good. And, you know, there has to be obviously protections in place so that people use it for the right reasons.
So where are you going with your research then? Do you see it coming like really quickly?
Yeah, I think it will. I think these blood tests, again, are right around the corner. But there's a lot of questions about how well they work in a non-clinical trial population. So, you know, all of the blood tests have been, you know, developed in a clinical trial population, which means that to be in a clinical trial, you can't really have anything else wrong with you other than Alzheimer's
disease. I see.
You know, the people running the trial don't want to get confusing results. You know, they want as straightforward of an analysis as possible. So those people are basically healthy other than having Alzheimer's disease. So how well are those tests going to work in your more realistic kind of everyday person, you know, who has type 2 diabetes, who has high blood pressure, who might have kidney disease, who might have liver disease, who might, you know, have had cancer in the past or might have some other issue. You know, do those blood tests work as well in those people? There also is part of the blood test that takes into consideration that gene I was talking about that can triple your risk for Alzheimer's disease. But it turns out that that gene, the effect of that gene is the strongest in people with European or Japanese ancestry and in people with African ancestry and Latin American ancestry. It actually does not increase the risk as much. Like we don't know why, but there might be a protective factor. And so there's some, again, ancestry dependent effects too of that particular blood test that we still are kind of trying to figure out. So we're trying to increase the diversity of our blood test development, because right now it's mainly focused on those of European ancestry. So diversity is a huge issue, but also just representing a more real world situation, you know, that you know, it's pretty rare to have someone who just has Alzheimer's. Again, that's most people have other health issues. So, you know, how do we bring this, you know, to make it a, to bring this to prime time, you know, we need to, expanded out a little bit in terms of who is being included in the studies. And that's one of the things that I'm doing at University of Minnesota is trying to bring more diversity to the study of these blood tests.
How can people find out more about Alzheimer's and where they can go to get help for it, et cetera, et cetera?
I really like the Alzheimer's Association website. The Alzheimer's Association is, in my opinion, the number one resource for patients and caregivers to learn about Alzheimer's disease. It also can teach someone about other types of dementing illnesses. It's a pretty easy website to remember. The website is alz.org.
Oh, that is good.
So it's the first three letters of Alzheimer's disease, so just alz.org.
All right.
And it's a very good website for learning about it. It has a lot of resources. There's actually a number that you can call and talk to someone. You know, there's a lot of philanthropy for Alzheimer's disease out there. And there's a lot of really generous people who are donating money to find a cure and to help support caregivers. And the Alzheimer's Association has gotten a lot of these funds to help with patients and caregivers. So I highly recommend going there. They have a great system, and that's my number one recommendation.
Dr. Manti, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I really appreciate your time. Lots
of
great
knowledge.
Yeah,
it was a pleasure, and thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. Good night.
All right, take care now.
Has been Disability and Progress. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of KFAI or its board of directors. My name is Sam. I've been the host of the show. Charlene Dahl is my research team. We've been speaking with Dr. William Manti, who is the from the University of Minnesota Medical School and M Health Fairview, and he specializes in diagnosis and care of neurodegenerative diseases. If you want to be on our email list, you can email me at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. We'll greatly stick you on and let you know what's coming up. Thanks so much for listening. Good night.
KFAI.org.